This is What Does It Profit? And I'm your host, Dr. Dawn Carpenter. In this show, we talk about value, the social and moral value of business. Each episode, each guest will bring me a little closer to finding out what does it profit. This week, as promised, we're going to spend a little more time in Washington. I want to talk to you about something that affects all of us. No, we're not going to be talking about insurrections or impeachments or even the new cast of characters in the executive branch. We're going to peek into what is the more normal side of Congress, the everyday business of trying to improve our lives. But remember, we're a business show. Let's face it, money matters, you know, whether you have a lot of it or not much of it. How we make it, spend it, invest it, or even how it's invested on our behalf. In one way or another, our money is connected with the incentives and the rules put on it by Congress. Leading the effort connecting sound and productive business investments with social and moral values is House Education and Labor Vice Chair Andy Levin.
Whether you're a worker who has a defined benefit pension plan, and so you, like every hour, some of your pay is separated off and goes into your retirement, or if you just have a defined contribution plan and you set aside money on your own through your employer, either way, you know, people have an interest in what that money is doing, and it should be invested in a responsible way to get a good return. And in addition, it should be invested in things that the worker feels like reflects their own values.
Now let's welcome to What Does It Profit, Congressman Andy Levin. Andy, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Dawn. It's so great to be with you.
Well, you are coming to us from actually from your office on the Hill, but representing the 9th Congressional District of Michigan. Tell everybody where that is.
Sure. The 9th District is in the suburbs of Detroit. It's no city and no rural. It's all inner suburbs of Detroit in Macomb County and Oakland County. Macomb County is the place that's famous for originating the term Reagan Democrat. And it's a place that's a very big hub of manufacturing and of blue collar workers in this country. So it's a big symbol of that.
Yeah, you know, you come to Congress from some of that place, right? You have your roots in the union world. Tell us a little bit about your background.
Well, sure. Yes. I spent many years in the labor movement. I was an activist as a college student. And then right out of college, I went to work for the Service Employees International Union, organizing nursing home workers. And then it's funny because of the ESG world. Then I went and did a master's degree in Asian languages and cultures. So I'm, you know, a lot of international interest and did human rights observation, including at that time in China during the Tiananmen massacre, for example. And then I came home and worked at the UAW Health and Safety Department, the auto workers, saving money and for law school. And then I went to law school where I was at Harvard Law School and I was the president of the Harvard Labor Law Project, again, focusing on workers' rights. And then I was a staff attorney for President Clinton's Labor Law Reform Commission, which was led by a Harvard professor of economics, John Dunlop, who had been on the World War II Price and Wage Board.
Wow. And you know, that's where we get the Dunlop report, right?
Exactly. And then I was in Secretary Reich's office, Robert Reich, when he was Secretary of Labor working on policy. Then I helped John Sweeney and Rich Trumka and Linda Chavez Thompson take over the leadership of the AFL-CIO. And for 11 years, I was the assistant director of organizing of the National AFL-CIO. And so that's all my years directly in labor movement. But then, you know, when I came home to Michigan, I was for 4 years the deputy director and the acting director of the Michigan Department of Energy, Labor, and Economic Growth. Again, you know, you talk about sustainable investment factors, just combining a lot of environment and climate change factors with labor factors. And I was Michigan's chief workforce officer. And so, you know, and now once I came to Congress, what did I do? You know, I immediately said I want to be on the Education and Labor Committee. And my first term, last Congress, my Democratic colleagues elected me as vice chair of the committee, which was a huge honor. And I really enjoyed playing that role. And, you know, now I'm back on the committee and I'm on the Foreign Affairs Committee. So really, I guess in a way, you know, my whole life has been about human rights, workers' rights around the world, workers having voice and power and a decent life in America, and, you know, the environment and our climate. I mean, I, you know, right before I came to Congress, when I left the state government in Michigan, I, for 8 years, I created and ran a statewide clean energy finance market in Michigan called Lean and Green Michigan. I guess my life kind of leads to an interest in this question of workers getting to have access to sustainable investments, getting a say over the investments that their pension funds and so forth, their ERISA-related plans make. Whether you're a worker who has a defined benefit pension plan, and so you, like every hour, some of your pay is separated off and goes into your retirement, or if you just have a defined contribution plan and you set aside money on your own through your employer, either way, you know, people have an interest in what that money is doing. And there are sort of twin components that go together to me. One is the money should be secure and it should be invested in a responsible way to get a good return. And in addition, it should be invested in things that the worker feels like reflects their own values, that they may cherish the earth, that we have clean air, clean water, clean land, that we not fry this one planet we have and make it uninhabitable for future generations. And so, you know, I just want to make sure that every fiduciary, every plan investor has a sustainable investment plan, and that the worker whose money it is being invested can, in plain English, in beautiful pie charts, whatever it is, see where their money's going and how it has an impact on the world.
Yeah, you know, I think there are a lot of people who are trying to make this happen. How do you see the role of legislation in this process? I see it as one component, but a really important one. Why do you need legislation in this area? Can't the market just do it itself?
I think that the role of legislation is to steer the markets in a broad direction and say, you figure out the details, you have a lot of freedom within the direction, but there are certain things that we're going to require to protect workers and their interests. So the markets do not figure things out on their own. And, you know, you can find so many examples. Let's remember seatbelts. Let's remember airbags. Let's remember that the companies involved resisted seatbelts being required in cars. They resisted airbags being required. And now, of course, you can't see an advertisement for a car without seeing such and such crash rating, and this many side airbags. So, you know, the government plays a role in saying that we need to go in a direction that protects the public, that protects workers' interests. And then companies do a wonderful job of, you know, taking advantage of that. And the problem is there are companies in, say, in the fossil fuel industry that will resist any idea that we should talk about the climate impact. There may be companies in manufacturing that say, you know what, we just want to quietly go to any corner of the world where the labor standards are the lowest, the pay is the cheapest, the environmental regulations are the fewest, so we can make whatever it is we make on the cheap and sell it cheaply and beat our competition. And I think what we're saying with requiring sustainable investment policy is, you know what, we need to throw some sunshine on the supply chain of our products, on the human rights practices of supply companies, on how workers in the company are compensated. What's the diversity policy of that company? Are they complying with taxes? Just the basic sort of corporate citizenship of the companies. And that creates an incentive, first of all, for companies to be good corporate citizens. And it also allows workers to say, you know what? I think my money's going to be the safest and I'm going to get the best long-term return on my investment if I invest in companies that realize that, you know what? We have to get to carbon neutrality here at some point as soon as possible. And companies on the leading edge of that are the ones that are going to make money. And the companies that resist it are not a very safe investment. And so it empowers workers actually through the mechanisms of capitalism itself to help steer our world in a healthier direction. And that's what Econ 101 would tell you investors should be able to do. But because of inequality of information, unless the government makes sure that workers have access to the information, you're pretty much guaranteed that they're not going to be able to participate in investment decisions in that way. So that's why I think legislation is so important.
So it sounds like what I'm hearing in all this is that there's a desire to want to empower investors with information. And you do this through providing a requirement for this type of disclosure. We saw, I guess, last year, the state of Illinois actually putting into place their Sustainable Investing Act on a state level. But this is, you know, groundbreaking at a federal level. Andy, now I understand the approach to this legislatively is coming in a two-bill package. Tell us what this is all about, how it's broken out, what's your vision for it?
Yeah, so we're doing it in two bills because we're amending two pieces of existing legislation that have been there for many years. So the Sustainable Investment Policies Act amends the Investment Advisors Act of 1940, and the Retiree Sustainable Investment Policies Act amends ERISA. But they essentially do the same thing. And the objective is to promote sustainable investment practices, improve ERISA plans' investment returns, and really require the plan fiduciaries, plan investors, not simply to act prudently and diversify retirement plans' investments to minimize risks of, you know, if you put all your eggs in one basket, you could have large losses, right? But we got to go beyond that and require them to have sustainable investment policies and to describe them, to have the investors, the workers, be able to understand them in reasonably plain English, and that they need to consider environmental, social, and governance, or ESG, factors that matter to people. So they would have to take into account corporate governance practices like executive compensation, board diversity, the independence of board chairs, political spending that, you know, is now allowed without limit because of Citizens United and so forth. They would have to take into account the characteristics of the workforces employed by the entities that are being invested in. So compensation, benefits, health and safety, diversity, training, you know, the use of independent contractors. They'd have to take into account labor and human rights compliance in terms of the entity itself and the supply chain, freedom of association, the right to bargain collectively, whether there's employment discrimination, child labor, forced labor, all of that kind of thing. And they'd have to the extent practicable, implement policies that enhance diversity and inclusion within the workforce, from senior leadership and the board of directors down throughout the workforce. And of course, they'd have to look at environmental factors, climate change risk, and a just transition for workers affected by climate change, if a company has that situation. Clean air, clean water, clean land. What about habitat destruction or species endangerment? Any kind of environmental degradation. So, you know, we want workers to be able to see these factors and make decisions for themselves, that if they care, basically, that they want their investments to be in a company that practices in a sustainable way and looks out for these ESG factors, they can do it. And, you know, the data we have suggests that that's actually a better investment anyway in a very quickly growing area of investment. In 2019, according to Morningstar, mutual funds focused on sustainable investing attracted more than $20 billion in assets, which was over four times what they attracted in 2018 in 1 year. So I don't assume it'll keep growing quite at that rate every year, but it's growing very fast. And again, according to Morningstar and others, the returns for sustainable investments that take ESG factors into account, did better in 2019, did better in the first part of 2020, that what we have data for so far, And so it makes sense that workers should be able to know about this and make investment decisions based on their own values.
Well, you know, I'm hearing all of this, and in a perfect world, we would all invest this way, but we're not there yet. And what I'm hearing is that this legislation that you're contemplating is really stipulating that there are review policies in place at the fiduciaries that would set some standard of review, but it's not requiring these investments, but it's saying we are going to consider them among the factors we consider as fiduciaries to determine what makes a good investment.
That's right. It's not saying that every investment has to be a model of ESG investing, but it's saying that they have to have a sustainable investment plan. So it's sort of in between. It's not just information. You know, they have to facilitate me as a worker being able to invest in a sustainable way if I want to. It's not saying that a whole family of mutual funds or a private equity firm that manages investments for a pension fund or whichever the actors we're talking about, it's not saying that they must clean all of their investments up. It's just saying that they have to have sunshine on this, a plan for me to be able to invest in a sustainable way, and, you know, make it possible for me to do so. And I think if you give me the chance and give me the information to do it, I think it's going to be very, very popular with investors. And, you know, I want to say something else about this, Dawn. As a congressman, one of my concerns is people have so little retirement saving at all. And partly that's because they're paid so little. But also young people just have a lot on their plate and they may not be thinking about investing and about saving. And I think if you want to get more young people in the game, this is a great step to take to say, you know what, right here at your job with this pension you're in or this, you know, 401k, whatever it is you have access to, you can invest sustainably. You can take human rights factors into account. You can take cleaning up the environment or saving us from overheating our planet into account in your investments. And I'm really hoping that's an engine of engagement with a whole generation of young people. And then when we go ahead and reduce their college debt and raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour and free everybody out to form a union if they want to.
We have nirvana.
Hopefully they'll have more money to invest. We got to do a few other things too, Dawn.
Oh, I know. It's this big puzzle with a lot of different pieces. And speaking of different pieces, you know, last summer, the Department of Labor was going crazy on this topic. And actually, in a way that I think a fair amount of mainstream investors were pushing up against. You know, maybe we could spend a couple minutes here talking about what was going on down the street from Congress over at the Labor Department, where they promulgated some new rules. The preamble of the new rules, you know, says something along the line of ESG is not a clear or helpful lexicon for a regulatory standard. How do you see this from down the street?
Well, I think that as the Biden administration comes in, I'm personally hoping that his Department of Labor will see if they can undo some of these hastily enacted rules. They had took the position that it's inappropriate for fiduciaries to take into account anything beyond the narrow definition of return on investment and risk. Forget about externalities, forget about any factors about how they treat their workforce and on and on. And I'll tell you, it's amazing what happened because the pushback, as you say, was not just from environmental groups or labor groups. The whole investment world really rose up and said, no, if you try to prevent us from doing this, you are tying our hands, you're limiting our options. And the comments were overwhelmingly negative, but they just went ahead and promulgated these rules. And so I think that it's going to be very important to take action. Now, both of the rules that the Labor Department promulgated would be overturned by these bills. But these bills will take quite a while to work their way through Congress. And
obviously, there's never a guarantee that a bill will be passed by the House and the Senate and signed by a president. So I'm really hopeful that the Labor Department will get us going in a direction that's more friendly to not just workers, but anybody being able to invest in a sustainable way if they want to.
Well, I'm hearing a Biden do-over, perhaps. We'll see.
Absolutely.
You know, it's interesting. They use this concept called pecuniary factor. I mean, if I'm going to go nerdy for just a minute, you know, it's this idea that fiduciaries are expected to consider those factors that have a material effect on the risk and return of an investment. But I think something that's come out of this conversation, and even out of some other conversations we've had on what does it profit, you know, investors are saying these ESG considerations do have a material effect on the economic value of these assets. And I think maybe that's an argument that needs to be talked about more.
Yeah, like, let's just take one example. My first trip as a member of Congress before COVID shut down travel in 2020, but in the fall of 2019, I went to Bangladesh as a member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, in part to look at the situation in the Rohingya refugee camps, in part to look at child nutrition issues. But I said, I want to spend a day looking at the conditions in the garment factories in and around Dhaka. And we visited different factories and different worker groups and so forth. And my observation is, even in a country, a much poorer country like Bangladesh, and where workers are poorly compensated, every worker or many workers are walking around with a quality of a camera in their pocket, in the form of a phone, that's far beyond what you or I might have walked around with 20 years ago. My point is that the idea that you can hide, say, human rights abuses in a garment factory, you know, sexual harassment, dangerous conditions. We've seen these tragic fires that are reminiscent of, you know, the Triangle Shirtwaist fire here that led to reform 100 years ago. Everybody can create an image and publish it and send it around the world. And so I think it's not some non-fiduciary thing, some not germane thing to the soundness of an investment to know that a company is polluting massively in a river in Vietnam or violating human rights in and around Dhaka in Bangladesh, or that they have a huge carbon footprint. I think that these things are directly germane to the soundness of the investment. And anybody who denies that is living in the 20th century, not the 21st.
Indeed. Yeah, I'll ask you the quintessential what does it profit question. You know, what does it profit looking at the world through these lens? It may seem obvious, but I'm interested in how you see it.
Well, Dawn, I mean, it profits us in many ways. First of all, it profits our souls. The idea that you have a way that you can see how your investments affect the world, that the companies you invest in might treat their workers well, that you might be able to invest in companies that are building new buildings in your communities with union labor, with workers who are well paid and have safe jobs, that you can invest in a way that directly leads to the greening of the economy. Investments in solar thermal, in wind, in offshore wind, in geothermal, in battery storage, and more. I think it makes people feel better. Secondly, I think that it will encourage people to invest more, younger people, which we desperately need to do in this country. And third, I actually think it can be an engine to drive us more quickly to an economy that does not rely on carbon emissions for people to move about the planet, to work, to live. And we must find every lever we have to tackle this climate change problem. You know, I'm going to tell you something. Late last month, a group of Harvard students, which I guess they have like some kind of a club that's a year or two old, of students who want to be involved in foreign policy. So they get opportunities to like write a report for a member of Congress on the Foreign Affairs Committee or somebody in the State Department. And they produced a wonderful report for me about what the Biden administration ought to do about Iran, which is a very complicated and difficult topic, right? And they did such a great job, but in a certain way, they were very conventional. there was one thing that was completely missing from their analysis of the vital and important interests of the United States, and that was climate change. And I said to them, this is fun for a 60-year-old guy to be telling a bunch of college students this. I don't much get an opportunity. But don't you think that protecting life on Earth as we know it, that it will continue to exist, is an interest of the United States that is so vital that it needs to be up there with nuclear nonproliferation and reducing Iranian activity in the, you know, like support for Hezbollah and the Houthi rebels and so all the other things that they were writing about. And they were really into it.
Yeah, but if you think about it, I mean, it kind of puts everything into perspective. Your portfolio has value X today, but if the world doesn't exist tomorrow, what is the value of that portfolio? It's nothing. It evaporates. So, Congressman Andy Levin, we have certainly enjoyed this conversation with you. Wish you the absolute best of luck on this legislation and want to help. So tell us how we can encourage our listeners to support what you're working on.
Well, that would be so great if anybody just Googles the Sustainable Investment Policies Act and the Retirees Sustainable Investment Policies Act, with or without my name, you'll come to these bills. I would encourage you to write, email, however you reach out to both of your senators. Every American has two senators and one representative.
Except if you live in Washington, D.C. I was just talking to one of your aides. That's a whole another podcast. Yes, so two senators for everybody but us in D.C.
Yes, and I'm a big proponent of D.C. statehood, but that's another discussion. So I encourage folks to write to each of those three. And if you happen to have a Democratic representative, but you live right next door to a Republican one, or you know one, or your cousin, or whatever it is, where your mom lives, or where you grew up, or whatever, find some Republicans, because I'm very intent on trying to make this bipartisan if possible. I've done that with a lot of different bills, and it's not something that immediately jumps to mind that a lot of Republicans would tend to support this. But there are Republicans who work with the building trades, who support Davis-Bacon and prevailing wage provisions. And those unions are so into this kind of investing, because their members always have good pensions. I'm really pushing for that. So folks could just write or email their senators and their congressperson and tell them, hey, support this Andy Levin's Sustainable Investment Policy Act and Retiree Sustainable Investment Policy Act. I want folks not to be cynical. I can tell you, as a sophomore member of Congress, just having completed my first term, it matters. Every week we find out how many people are writing about A, B, and C. And you know what? Especially if they write not in a form or some kind of mass campaign, but they write individually, it really matters. And you help shape the future policy of this country. So I hope folks will do that. And then come see me when they come to Washington.
Excellent. An invitation and a civics lesson. We will make sure that in our show notes, not only do we have links to these bills, but also we'll have a link to the directory so our listeners can find their members fast and easy and right away.
Wonderful.
Congressman Levin, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Dawn. Thanks for your great podcast. It's really great to learn about it and to get to participate. Take care.
You've been listening to What Does It Profit? Thanks to all of those of you who've gotten the word out about the show, especially our friends at If Only You Knew podcast, the Australian podcast that delves into the pivotal moments in the lives and careers of people from around the world. Last week, I shared my own story on If Only You Knew. Take a listen to If Only You Knew wherever you get your podcasts. In our next episode, we're going to Wall Street. Metaphorically speaking, we're going to talk about Robinhood, GameStop, hedge funds, and all things crazy in the world of finance. Actually, there's no way to do all that in a single podcast episode, but we're going to talk with a very unusual person in the hedge fund world who has stood up to say that the finance industry can do better.
There's an underlying current of anger at inequality, for good reasons, right? And recently, the object of that anger has been hedge fund managers, which is completely understandable, as one group of individuals who have disproportionately benefited from the system for no particularly good reasons. Now, the issue though with Robinhood is not necessarily that they're making this like trading free. The issue is that they're gamifying investing in very unhealthy ways.
Next on What Does It Profit? J.C. DeSwan, hedge fund investor, Princeton finance ethicist, and the author of the book Seeking Virtue in Finance, Contributing to Society in a Conflicted Industry. Until next time, follow us on social media to keep up with the show and to help us build the What Does It Profit community. We are hanging out mostly on LinkedIn and Twitter at the moment, and please don't forget to subscribe and tell your friends about the show. You can meet our team and sign up for our weekly newsletter on our website, whatdoesitprofitpodcast.com. What Does It Profit is written and hosted by me, Dr. Dawn Carpenter. This episode was produced by guest producer Lucy Wang. Special thanks to our talented interns, Niels, Hannah, and Sean. Other team members and our long and illustrious group of friends and supporters can be found at whatdoesitprofitpodcast.com. Before I let you go, let me remind you to never stop asking yourself, what does it profit?